Thank you. Thank you very much, Tina, and thank you for everybody for being here. I'm just going to start by framing the discussion a little bit in saying the reason why the gallery and I invited Nikki to have a discussion with me was because I'm also working on another project for the Venice Biennale next year, and so Nikki and I were kind of in conversation about certain things already, and I thought he would have an interesting perspective on this material as well. And I also just wanted to start by opening by kind of telling a little bit the story of how I put the show together and the logic that that I went through in making the show, just to kind of give you a quick background. Some people probably know this already, but So I came across, I live in Germany, and but I'm from New Zealand, and I like watching television, and I was using streaming services to keep up with my American and British TV when I was living in Germany, because everything is dubbed there, so everything's in German, even if it's originally English-speaking material. And so I was using a bunch of streaming services for that, and one of those services is... one of the services that was the best was Mega Video, and then all of a sudden it went down. And then I kind of checked my Facebook feed, and there was a bunch of stuff about Kim and the big raid that happened in Coatesville. And it was interesting for me because it came both from like technology news, which I kind of follow anyway because that's an interest of mine, so international technology news, and very much New Zealand local news. And right at that moment, I didn't really know what I was going to do with this thing, but it seemed to me too good a story to waste. And so I asked my father and my mother to collect their Herald articles about Kim as more material came out, and it just got kind of better and better. And for me, all of these kind of issues that I was thinking around anyway, privacy, access to information, property, differences in levels of wealth, all of these kind of things kind of came together in one great kind of story. In that research process, I came also across the indictment document that the U.S. authorities made, and at the end of the indictment document, obviously, is this long list of things that was seized during the raid, and I thought that this would be a great proposition for a sculpture, in a way, because... it was an interesting way to think about collections and collecting, because obviously, on the one hand, it's collected by Kim and it's material that this guy selected, but on the other hand, it's also selected by the U.S. authorities. So it's this kind of, if you think about it as a Venn diagram, the kind of meeting point of those two systems seemed to me a pretty interesting place to start for a sculpture that would stand in for these ideas that I was thinking about. So that's the moment when I sort of thought, that would be a good exhibition, and wouldn't it be an amazing thing to see some kind of visualization of 60 bank accounts, $175 million in cash, I didn't even know what that would be as a mass, and 25 luxury vehicles, all of these kind of, a small collection of artworks, and then I started my conversation with the first venue which took it on, which was the MUMOC in Vienna, the Museum of Modern Art there, who are a collecting institution, but who show and collect with very different criteria than Kim or the U.S. authorities. So then I started to put it into perspective, these kind of surrogates, stand-ins, graphic visions of Kim's material, and tried to kind of bring it all together as a kind of exhibition experience. And just things that I was thinking of when I was making these things, and thinking about what could stand in for bank accounts and what could stand in for these vehicles, something that came very much to the forefront was an idea of scale and resolution. So obviously Kim has been accused of facilitating distribution of copies of things, and we've all watched or listened to material in various different states of quality. So when I was watching TV, sometimes you get a very pixelated version of a movie, sometimes you get quite a nice... high-quality version of a movie. I was thinking about this in the way that the show would come across as well. So obviously with some of the items, particularly in other parts of the show, I was able to, for example, borrow the exact make and model of Mercedes that he had. And that is, for me, like a high-res image of that object, in a way, as a sculpture. But then now also you have kind of a model or even just a pixelated image of that same car here. So format and kind of scale and and resolution was something I was thinking a lot in as a kind of sculptural tool in doing this as well. So I hope that kind of locates a little bit where the project came from my side. I think I want to kind of get Nikki involved in the conversation at this point, it's just so it's not a one-sided thing. And Nikki has a really great perspective on another thing which I found very interesting about the whole story the whole way along, is the way that the perception of Kim, particularly in New Zealand, as we're here now, has changed a lot. And I don't know if you want to talk to that idea, but that's something that's very interesting for me as a durational project, right? This is the third time I've made this exhibition, and each time the moment of Kim and the way he's received has been quite different, you know? Over to you, Nikki.
Good morning. I hope that people who are here will actually, if you've just come along for the talk, that the main thing you will do is to go down through the levels of the gallery and experience the exhibition, because it's really cool, and you'll see. But what we're going to talk about is, I'm not an expert on Kim.com, it's not my subject or anything, but we're going to talk about the issues around it because it's a really interesting subject. And I wanted to say one thing before that, which is that there's something a bit weird about talking about a person. You know, when people are larger than life, it seems like they become public property, but actually he is just a person. But he's also been a person who has been, he's sort of been a shocking or interesting part of our history in New Zealand for a little while, and he reflects back New Zealand to us and the way he's been reacted to and the way he's been talked about. So just as my start of the conversation here this morning, I want to talk about how I think Kim.com has been seen, which of course is a story about New Zealand at least as much as him, is what I'm saying. So first of all, maybe some people had been aware of him, but I hadn't been very much, so we mainly became aware of him at the same time as Simon, where you came into it, which was when suddenly there was this kind of gangster impression being put through the news media because of the way that his house got raided, and that he was an object, that he was a criminal, and that something that was sort of like a mafia person had been uncovered in the hills north of Auckland. And at the same time, because when someone's a criminal, there's an interest in news which kind of demonizes them a bit, that's when we got out the first side of our public impressions on his wealth, because we've got a country which is ambivalent, got very sort of mixed views about wealth, in that part of the view of wealth is that people who are wealthy are honored and are seen as being higher or something, and another way they're slightly despised, and there's the trappings of wealth are not appreciated. And so the trappings of his wealth, like his ridiculous cars and little number plates and things, was part of the narrative of the mafia bad kind of person. But this didn't last very long, which is a credit to the news media, because the intention was that he was going to become a villain, be wrapped up in a box and sent to the US to be to be put through the court system there for his copyright breaches. And it wasn't very long at all when the bad person mafia image started to disintegrate, and there were journalists who did their work properly and saw that, hang on a moment, he actually hasn't done anything wrong apart from what the whole world was doing, which is copying or facilitating the copying of bits of stuff on the internet, which is what the life and the purpose and the creativity of the internet was supposed to have in large part be about. And so this is much more complicated than just saying, here's a blatant criminal. The words about him being a money launderer, which sounds like a mafia person who moves money from their casino through the British Virgin Islands to somewhere, suddenly we realise that money laundering was actually just about the fact that if you call someone a criminal, then everything they do with money is called money laundering, and it wasn't quite as exciting as we hoped. So his the first stage of Kim.com, which is in part reflected in the exhibition here, seized property, criminal rounded up, disintegrated quite fast, and there was a more balanced view, which is a good thing about our culture as a country, that he could be seen as not necessarily just in a caricature way as a baddie. So that was phase one of Kim.com, and then when he was rich, there was a second factor to him, which is another part of his wealth, which was that although the legal system should protect everyone equally, someone who's got millions and billions of money to get good lawyers does go through the legal system differently. And one of the things that happened while he was going through the legal system differently was that his warrants were checked for the raid on his house, And it was discovered that there were people involved in the raid that the authorities didn't want to admit, which was the GCSB. And that was the beginning of the next phase of his reflecting back and kind of stirring up New Zealand life far beyond himself, which was to do with the unlawful surveillance of him by the GCSB, which is that we'd had a law covering our foreign spy agency. The GCSB is a foreign spy agency. It spies on the South Pacific. It spies on Asia. It does it essentially for the United States, which is another theme about this man and the FBI coming here and everything. But that's what it does. And the law said that the GCSB would never spy on a New Zealander, that there was just a bit, it will not spy on New Zealanders, which seemed to be pretty clear and unambiguous, and trusting people like me believed that they would be doing that, I have to confess. And then we found that not only Kim.com was being spied on, because lawyers found out that this was really weird that there were GCSB people part of the raid, but then when it was looked into, there were other people as well. So this was the next big stir about him. I'm nearly finished. I'm not going to take too long. And so that he went from being kind of an outlaw, but who was an attractive outlaw who people liked because of the copyright things, through to being the victim of this stuff, and it was magnified his outlaw status, and he became very popular, particularly with young people in New Zealand and things. It was a very interesting character. And then there was the third phase of his involvement in New Zealand, which was when he decided to go into politics, which has been a muddy, mixed kind of a time, frankly, where I think he was dealing in something where he was not experienced, and he's a clever person, and he's a very creative person, he's a very driven person, is my impression from the outside, and he played politics very well in some respects, and he completely stuffed it up in other respects, is my personal opinion. And then the final stage of the story is that when things hadn't gone well in the political part of his career, and he'd sort of messed it up a bit, he humanized himself perhaps more than ever before, in that he was the one politician who was prepared after the election to say he'd done something wrong and that he regretted it, which I think is a fabulous part of his career in New Zealand, and I wish that I wish there were more people would do that when they're involved in politics. And the final thing I would say is that this interesting character who has, you know, a large in life character who has stirred up so many things and been part of so many bits of our country, the story's not over yet, and I think we've got various more chapters to come.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for that part, Nikki. Yeah, I mean, return, I don't know, if we kind of go back and forth from what our areas of interest are in relation to this conversation. I think the ambivalence to wealth is something that is also something that I was had in mind in putting this project together, because, of course, another thing that brought this group of objects together is value, right? The reason why they were confiscated is because they were financially valuable things, and to kind of work with the resolution idea as well, and the kind of like the different levels of trying to visualize this material. Obviously, there's a big disparity between the wealth and the kind of worth of the objects that are depicted in the show and the way they're depicted, which is on a far lesser scale in terms of money. So, I mean, while it's for me, relatively, I've done quite well with the production money that we've had available. It's definitely not approaching anywhere near the value of even one of these things that are available. And I think that difference, a kind of let's say poor resolution or kind of poor view on the material, was I think another kind of tension which I found interesting.
And can I ask you a question?
Yes, you can.
You're going to get to ask some questions in a while, but I'm up here. One of the things which strikes me, standing down in the bottom of here, looking, just taking it in rather than looking at the detail, is that you're seeing a line of the names of the big banks of the world, one after another. All these banks where the money was confiscated and which were happy to do business in something which was then going to be called a criminal enterprise. Were you imagining us seeing bank, bank, bank. Was that part of what you were wanting us to see?
Absolutely, because that's what this list was all about. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, it's kind of a boring first half of the list, because it is like bang, 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 bang. But then it starts to kind of you know, grow. And it's also interesting where these banks are, you know, and it's interesting that you have kind of state, you know, banks that are associated with states and other banks which are less associated with states. I mean, Kiwi Bank is one of the things that's here, which is interesting that he has. He also has government bonds. New Zealand government bonds is one of the kind of financial instruments with Computershare bonds. So it's these are kind of pretty interesting things to see. And just the just seeing the mass of this material, because, of course, a list is a very abstract thing, or a more abstract thing than some kind of visualization of it. And I think, one of the things I wanted to do in the show was kind of get across a real feeling of, wow, this really is a lot of banks, or this really is a lot of money, or this really is a bunch of stuff that has a real mass to it. And, again, from a sculptural perspective, the massiveness of Kim and the mass of the things that coming across was something that I wanted to kind of push in the show, you know.
And using my sitting up here again,
yes.
Something else which I find interesting is that this is the third time this has been, roughly, this exhibition has happened. And I'm interested in the way that it was a non-New Zealand audience that saw it the first time, and how were they interested in Kim.com? Because he's such a, you know, he's a big part of life here, of the public life.
Yeah. That has been very interesting. So the first time I put the show on was mid-2013, after a period of gestation and trying to make it happen. And that was in Vienna, in Austria. So Kim's a different guy in the German-speaking world. So while Austria's not Germany, and Kim is German, he's from Kiel, but he had a career in the German-speaking world and in Germany, kind of before he moved to Hong Kong and then before he moved to New Zealand. And so they remember him as Kim Schmitz, and he was in the headlines for a moment there for a bunch of activities. He was in trouble with the law briefly, and that's something that I think, as I understand it, he regrets. I've read in a number of reports on the matter. Kim Schmitz is of interest in the German-speaking world, and kind of another iteration of that was interesting. And also, I think the night that we opened in Vienna, Snowden was supposed to be on a plane that flew over Austria. So that was also kind of an interesting moment, and a kind of, obviously a re-energization of this discussion that happened in New Zealand, but people were kind of interested because of that. So I had a lot of German-speaking newspapers come to the opening, and we had a lot of kind of media discussion over there. So in Germany and in Austria, that was a kind of something they were interested in. But it's also in terms of, just to kind of bounce off that question, each of the three times has been a very different presentation and at a very different moment in this reception of Kim and the issues around Kim. And each time there's been, the list stays the same, but the objects change, and also the kind of way that they read changes, you know, which is something I find very interesting as an artist as well. For the first couple of shows, so first it was in Austria, the second was in England, which was in January this year, also a different time because it was just kind of before Kim was really entering a political arena here in a more active way. But England has a relationship to New Zealand, and The Guardian reports on various things that Kim was doing in the last few years. So people are interested in Kim in England because they're somewhat interested in what happens in New Zealand as well, you know. But he is also standing in for these larger conversations in the tech world. And we had a symposium in Colchester in Essex where the show was, and there were a number of academics speaking around ideas ways of making archiving the digital and archiving ephemeral aspects of what is involved in digital culture, which is one of the, again, more formal aspects of what I deal with in this presentation. Everybody knew about Kim. I had this guy Charles Graeber come and speak, who did the Wired article, cover article on Kim in 2012. And he had a lot of opinions about staying with Kim, quite different opinions to you on Kim, actually. That was also an interesting voice to bring in. But also I think something that I tried to do here was really locate the story in a bigger way somehow. So these, for example, these were plaques in the first two exhibitions. They were tiny A6 metal printed plaques that kind of read as signs, you know, more. And here they read as giant canvases. I kind of literally bumped the scale up, you know. And it also gave me
Why plaques?
Yeah, because, you know, when you have a bunch of objects, you need labels for those objects. And, you know, this was working with basic kind of expectations of, I guess, exhibition making, display. That was what I was trying to work with in the beginning, you know. So kind of it would be a label for each object, right? But here they kind of blow up and they become something else because they're a different scale, because they're on different material. They read more as kind of graphic posters or paintings because they're on canvas. And then also part of meeting the context here and trying to situate that a bit more in the local conversation is I worked with Cut Collective, this group of graffiti artists here, which I didn't work with in other iterations at the show. And they were commissioned before the raid in 2012 to do this amazing painting or mural in Kim's gaming room. So Kim's an avid gamer, and he was very good at Call of Duty, as everybody probably knows. And that there's a kind of miniature version of this this quite now evocative and has other associations painting that they made, and then it has kind of excerpts where that painting or quotations from that painting or derivations from that painting kind of meets these label surfaces of my renderings of Kim's material. So that's also about kind of creative processes and different creative logics in posing this material as one, as a kind of, as an interface to the local context in a way, you know, if that makes sense.
There's another part of the local context I'd like to raise and see what you think of. Yeah. And that is that we have a bad habit, I think, in the news media, and that means in public discussion here, where once somebody is famous or a celebrity, everything they do is going to be newsworthy in some way. And so people become famous for being famous, and often right. beginning with something rather banal or like being rich. And certainly Kim.com had that, and he hasn't stuck with that because his political activities have been dramatic and things. But there's a large extent to which I think once he had been raided and because he was rich, he was then doomed to that being put through the machine, the sausage machine of being someone who you would always like to hear about the next thing about. In other words, he's magnified in a way which is harmful to him and not very sort of intelligent for us, I think. And I wonder whether that's that kind of idea has found itself into what you're trying to say about his hubcaps and, you know, his license plates and all the rest of it, you know. I'm talking about the way that somebody ceases to be a person and they get over magnified and it's you know, they just become some stuff.
Yeah, I guess for me that's kind of a fact. That's like something that happens. And that's definitely reflected in, I think, the logic of the way that this show comes together and is presented. But I don't have a position on that as such, you know. That's a thing that happens, and I think that's an interesting thing that happens culturally. Whether it's a positive thing or a negative thing, for me, is that's not for me to decide, you know.
That's all my ideas, actually.
Yeah,
we're going to go to questions, but do you want to finish off?
No, I think that's a good place to open up to the floor. There's lots of people here. Maybe there's some questions to be asked. Maybe there isn't. Let's open it up. Yes. Yes, I mean, I think that's a nice observation. I don't make that. Oh, that's a good idea for the next one. It's a kind of a long question, so I don't know if I can accurately reiterate. Okay, so Maya. My understanding of the question is about proximity, and it's about the proximity of what I'm doing in an art sense and how close that is to life, as you put it, and where art and life meets, and the fact that the show has been in different moments and in different places has kind of approached closer to life here. I think that was the way that the question was. So I was about to say that that's not a way which I see personally, which I see. I see art as a part of life. It's kind of, for me, it's a little artificial to say art's outside of life, right? It is life, and is a part of life. But I think where I can relate to the framing of that question is proximity is a very important question for me as a creator. And sometimes I'm very close to subjects, and very very much in conversation with the subject of exhibitions that I make. And sometimes I keep a distance. And with this project, I wanted to keep a distance from the subject. And so I haven't been in any kind of conversation with Kim directly. Whether that would be possible or not is another question. But it is it's something which I think strengthens the project, the fact that it's not close to him in a way. And even though it enters different zones where he's viewed differently and viewed more or less importantly or as a wider figure or not, I think the exhibition's relationship to his personal position is quite far. Oh yes, I agree. So the comment was his observations, Kim's observations of the exhibition would be very interesting, and I totally agree with that. But that's kind of after the fact, right? That's reception. That's not production. So what I was talking about in terms of proximity and subject matter to me is, for example, I just made an exhibition that was showed at the Auckland Art Gallery, and that was about a tech conference in Munich. And for that exhibition, I was very close to the subject matter. So that particular tech conference gave me material to work with. I had permission to do everything I did. They saw the exhibition as it was coming out. While they didn't kind of work on it with me or define creatively any way that it could come out, my proximity to them and obviously influenced the way that I depicted them as well. You know, so that's what I mean a little bit there. But yes, I think Kim's opinion on the exhibition would be fantastically interesting. Yeah.
So, given that Nikki thinks there are more iterations to come, do you see yourself continuing to work with this material?
I think this is a pretty good pause for this project, if it's not a stop. I mean, I've got a number of other projects that I want to work on now. And I think, parts of this project could be shown again as a part of some things, but I think this has been a pretty good pause, at least. So I never want to say never, but it's not a high priority for me after doing this, which I'm very happy with.
Just following on from that, Nikki, you've talked about the three ages of Kim. What do you think is going to happen next? And I don't want you to go to the seven ages of Kim necessarily. And if you don't think that's a fair question, you can just make something up. We won't know the difference. But I'd be interested in your views about how this is going to play out in the medium term, anyway.
So I think the interesting thing is that it's really unclear how it's going to play out, as in. While he was involved in politics, I thought that his rise to being an unintentional hero figure for a lot of people in New Zealand was going to crash and burn. And I thought that his apology after the election was really outstanding and interesting in heading that off. And he's still got a court case coming. He's still got rounds of court cases coming, which may end up with news photographs of him being led onto a plane and deported and punished in the United States, which would undoubtedly happen. Or it might not, and he may become part of New Zealand life, and then he may drop into obscurity, or he may be interesting in ways that we can't even tell yet. Or there's also the possibility, which I don't think is the main possibility, but I think it's a complete possibility, that 5 years from now or 10 years from now, he'll be gone, he'll be living in Hong Kong or somewhere, and we were just a little stopover. And we'll have to look at ourselves, that everyone got so excited about him, and he was so part of our lives, and then he moved on. And I don't think there's any clarity at all, and I don't think he knows, because he's been changing. I don't think he's been using New Zealand as some people say. I think he was kind of a crazy, creative, rich boy, and then he was politicized to some extent by his experiences. And then he's had an experiment in politics, which he was kind of immature about in some ways and creative in others, and then it's crashed. And I think he's learning and changing through the process, is my view. I don't have a negative picture of him. And who knows what's coming next.
Hi. I was really struck by Nikki's comment about Kim.com being more of a mirror for New Zealand rather than this being about him as a person. And I think that's really, really quite accurate, but he's a bit of a false mirror. And there are a few things that have struck me about this exhibition, and I guess having followed the Kim.com story since the raid, it really struck me when the raid occurred, there was this very carefully crafted, it seemed to be a very carefully crafted media package that had been suddenly released to the media with a whole lot of images of him posing on airplane runways with fast cars and women, and they were really, really trying to paint him as this playboy kind of gangster figure. And then there was the Campbell Live interview where he completely turned it around and he became a family man who was a victim. And in all of that, all of those iterations, I came to the show and looked around, and then it suddenly struck me that he kind of owns a lot of porn URLs, and I kind of wonder how much that features in his business and why that hasn't been talked about in the media here. Was it discussed in England and in Austria when the show was shown, and what does that say about us? And also, you know, it's very much, you know, looking at these objects from an NSA perspective, it kind of paints this picture of a gangster as Cadillacs and as money, but there aren't any guns or any bling, and so that's kind of something that's missing. And I'm just kind of interested in what does this say about New Zealand, I guess?
There's a lot of ideas that you brought to the table there, and I'll speak to the ones that resonate with me. I think in terms of the gangster thing, I think it's a pretty interesting, if I can comment aesthetically, let's say. I think the location of a lot of the kind of stuff for me comes from two different moments and a kind of maybe two different subcultural sources. One is gaming culture, right, which he is very much a part of. And you know, cars and bling and you know, raids. I mean, this kind of stuff somehow works within that culture really well, right? And the second thing is tech culture. You know, tech entrepreneurship culture, which is another subculture that I think I would locate him within. And they're very into graffiti art, and they're really into kind of, I'm just reading a Ben Horowitz book, who's a very famous VC from Silicon Valley, photographs himself in front of, some graffiti art for the author shot. Facebook, they have resident artists coming through making murals, which are from this culture as well. So I think aesthetically, that's where those locators come from, and they've been, as you've mentioned, recast by the New Zealand media maybe and by the reception as this kind of Dr. Evil thing a little bit more. But all of this kind of logic, I think it's locatable, is I think what I want to say. And so you can look at those things aesthetically and find origins for them which are not the same origins as being ascribed to. So that's one thing. And then I forgot what else I was going to comment on. Right, the porn thing. I think that's a business model question from my perspective. So this is, again, an opinion. But, if you're thinking about making internet business models, and Kim is an entrepreneur, definitely, and a very successful one at certain moments in his life, I guess there's a lot of revenue in those things, you know. And I think that's, for me, that's not a particularly interesting issue for me to think through.
I don't know about the porn URLs, which I would tend to make me feel negatively towards him. And I would have thought that if that was common knowledge and well documented, I'm surprised if that's common knowledge and well documented that it hasn't gone in the news. And I don't think there would be any sense of reticence on the part of at least some of the media to publicise that. So I just don't know the answer to that. What I think we should take notice of is that many of the creative people in the world are not doing art exhibitions. They're working in public relations and marketing and places, and unfortunately in the world, it's the way it is. and that the preparations that you talked about for convicting somebody includes a huge component of this. And what I'm talking about in a generalized way is that before you go to war somewhere, we've all got used to the public relations or the propaganda side of international politics and of all politics and of public events, that we're used to the phenomenon that there's someone who the world hasn't even heard of, and over the period of a few weeks or a few months, they become the worst person in the world, and we all know about the terrible things about them, and then the attack will happen, and then gradually we'll find that maybe they weren't terrible, but actually that was just preparation for the attack, and it's unrealistic to think that the same thing wouldn't happen with a figure who was going to be a major target of the FBI and they're kind of their poster boy for trying to crack down on copyright, that there would be demonization goes on, that demonization of targets of organized attacks and things, whether military or otherwise, is a reality of the world. And all we can do is hope that other people become literate and conscious of those kind of tactics, and we roll our eyes when we see it happening again, and we are suitably skeptical, that we don't become cynical people, we become skeptical people who are aware of it and don't fall for it each time. And actually I see it as being a perfect subject for the intersection of public relations and art to look at the way that the misuse of that kind of stuff.
Simon, congratulations. I think it's a really insightful kind of lensing on a piece of cultural artifact that you've found and brought here.
Thank you.
On the art life thing, I'd just like to offer a little comment, which is something like you bringing this cultural artifact to this art institution and therefore calling it art, I guess. I just think I had a chuckle on the way here thinking perhaps Kim.com could come and buy it. Which just made me laugh.
Everything's available. Yeah,
it's interesting crossovers between art and life. But like, I think more serious question I have is, and sorry if I'm a bit late for arriving, if you haven't covered it, but surely this entire thing is actually about some version of invasion of a corporate entity via a state called America into our state, Hollywood coming here. And I obviously that's deeply political, and I've noticed that you've shied away a bit from the word political around the show. Have you got some comments about that?
I guess it's about, I mean, I can only answer for myself here. I think it's, for me, it's, my area of interest and my area of specific expertise is cultural, let's say, and I think while culture always obviously has a political dimension, I'm very interested in analyzing material that is politicized in a cultural framework. I think that's worth doing, even if things are heavily politicized, and maybe precisely because they're heavily politicized. So I think this kind of sovereignty thing and the corporate thing, the things that you mentioned, and America's presence and U.S. culture in general, I think that's something much more complicated and a little like deeper culturally than just kind of the political moves that are happening or around that area. I grew up in this country, and then I left this country and have been living outside this country for a little while. And it's interesting for me, I guess everybody goes through this who travels, but for me it's always interesting to kind of look back on my past and think about my upbringing. And I realized being away, and my partner's from a different culture. She's from a non-English speaking context. She's an Italian woman living in Germany. And so, we often compare upbringings, and, she's... a non-English-speaking upbringing is a really different thing than an English-speaking upbringing, even in a Western context, I realized how much I naturalized U.S. culture as a New Zealander growing up here, And I sort of remember, watching The Cosby Show or something and kind of expecting Brooklyn to kind of be around the corner, or you know what I mean? Like, somehow I didn't really make those distinctions, and I think that shows to me the kind of subtlety and complexity of the way that we naturalize culture that we consume. And I think that's definitely like a undercurrent of my project here and other projects I've been in. But yeah, I think those things are muddy and complicated, and you're never able to really unpack what that is, but it's there. And that's, I think, something that's very interesting for me in this thing. Yeah.
Hi, for Nikki. I just wonder, is this, you know, the 60 bank accounts around the world, is that something specific to Kim.com? Because I know that you have done some research or been involved in some research about tax dodging of business structure. If you would make a raid with Bill English or, you know, John Key, would you find the same amount of bank accounts somewhere?
I have spent a large chunk of my recent past digging into the tax havens of the world, which is a totally fascinating subject, which most ordinary people know nothing about and will never be involved in, and a small subsection of the world know lots about and are deeply involved in. But I've never studied Kim.com. So there are different reasons why people use tax havens. And it's like an alternative reality in the world. There are, just to explain what it is, because I didn't understand it properly, there are, you know, we have countries with banks and rules and laws like you do in New Zealand. And then you have this series of lawless zones dotted around mainly the tropics, starting with the Cook Islands and Samoa and Vanuatu, but the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands and Montserrat and in the Caribbean, and all these little, mostly British-oriented, because a lot of this, Britain is the money laundering center of the world, but there's all these places around the world which are dedicated to being lawless zones for the moving and holding and transferring of money, which facilitates crime as well as tax dodging on a massive scale and is affecting the whole world. I'm just mentioning this because it's so interesting, not because it's really very relevant, actually. And so I worked on that for a long time, trying to track people through that system, and had a certain amount of success with an international study, which is why I know about it. So there are two kinds of people who use that. There are the clearly unlawful, dodgy, hiding their activity, pornography companies, secret business, people who are doing stuff they don't want found out. And then there is every other kind of big business in the world does it. And it's lawful tax dodging, basically. And I would assume that Kim.com was on the lawful tax minimization, shall we call it, side of it. And tax meaning that they were lawful, and it was done by lawyers in New York and all the rest of it. So that's the side I would see it. And all I would say is that for all of us, if we want to understand the world, any little glimpse through into that, so we've got a better understanding of how the world works, is worthwhile. And the line of all the banks in this room are just reminding us that the way the world works is far more complicated than we realize in that realm. So I don't know much to answer your question, but it's really interesting.
I'd like to speak to that because that intersects with a project I did recently on this topic. So that's of interest to me in a way as well, because I'm interested in the rhetorics of the rhetoric around Silicon Valley and tech entrepreneurship and TED conferences, TED talks is something that is like a format for that, a very well-known format. I think here a lot of people know what it is. And I organized, TED licenses its conferences to various places around the world. So, you know, people, I think there's a TEDx Wellington, I think there's a TEDx Auckland. It's a format that's started and exists in the tech entrepreneurship world. And I organized with a friend of mine, Daniel Keller, TEDx Vaduz. And Vaduz is the capital of Liechtenstein, which has been described as a tax haven. My interest in kind of putting, bringing those two brands together, let's say, the brand of TED and the brand of Liechtenstein, was a pretty interesting thing around that area, because also a lot of these tech people, and this relates also to the Kim story a little bit, often call for separate laws in separate states. This is like something that really interests them, and it's often a case of like avoiding regulation and, you know, aiding better innovative techniques. And, you know, Larry Page at the I.O., like at least last year or the year before, called for an idea of exit, and other tech entrepreneurs are very interested in this idea of seasteading, which is like going into international waters with a kind of floating island or a boat or something like that, where you are not in a state anymore and then kind of starting a state. And so these things are all pretty interesting. And Liechtenstein is a, just to give you a bit more breakdown on what I did with it, Liechtenstein is a quadruple landlocked country, right? So it's like it's right in the center of Europe, I designed a stage. So while TED has a number of aesthetic guidelines to what you're able to do in the presentation of your TED conference, they also have some freedoms. And one of the freedoms is you're able to design the stage pretty much yourself. And so I designed this stage along with Dan, where Liechtenstein was rendered as a kind of an island. So the speaker, the TED speaker, would be standing on this kind of tropical island, offshore, let's say, island, and speaking about issues around tax avoidance. And the backdrop was a kind of giant tag cloud of the top words that have ever been said in TED conferences. So thanks came up a lot, and thing came up a lot. And so, you know, this was a way to kind of locate that all in that one space, yeah, as well. Anyway, just to tack something else on.
I was interested in you mentioning the word brand there. Nikki, at the start you talked about Kim being a person and also the scrutiny that's been given to him, but he's also a person that kind of is literally a brand. He has changed his name to a brand name. So there also seems to be the sense in which he's playing the role. It's not just the media sort of casting him as a villain, but he's sort of at various times, I think, played with that kind of scrutiny. So I'm interested in whether his own sort of complicity in that branding changes the sort of the relationship between scrutiny, media, and a person. And I'm also interested for Simon whether you think what you're doing in a show like this disrupts his brand or whether it amplifies it. Because I think you're also complicit in this kind of branding and starting your own mega video company as well.
Yeah, fair comment. I think that people have got, you can be a person and you can be a show person and you can have different roles going on at once. And he has enjoyed the role of the showman and presenting himself to the world in a particular way. But he's still a person at the same time as well, completely. Like, we should all know that. We should know that when we see people through their image, that we're only just getting a tiny part of them. So yes, you're right, and yes, most of them isn't like that, actually. So he's, for commercial purposes and also for playful reasons and for cheeky reasons and all kinds of things, and maybe through ego and various complicated reasons, he's enjoyed projecting himself into the public. And that's, I think that's the folly of celebrities, that they start to actually, they run the risk that they lose themselves a bit and they play that game too much. And therefore they make themselves public property, which is why it is legitimate for us to be talking about some of it here. But at the same time, they're people, and we should be conscious enough to realize that most of them isn't actually what they're projecting out there. That's what I think.
I have a pretty different take on that, and I'll locate it in, again, another project I did. Is I recently did some research into the startup community in Berlin. And I was talking to a lot of young founders of companies about, you know, why they get involved in making companies and all these kinds of things. And I found that that companies and brands, young companies and brands, and young founders often get kind of personified as one thing, right? So a founder is supposed to stand in for the values of his company. And I think that that's also true for art and for artists. I think artists are also kind of should stand for the values of the brand, let's say. And these roles are kind of so muddy, and you know, when you're on brand, when you're performing, when you're not, I just think they're completely, one's not able to step outside of that ever. You know, so if you enter a public discussion, if you enter a public realm in any kind of a way, I feel like you never sort of step out of that role. You know.
We're nearly finishing, but can I disagree? it's entertaining, but if we want to have, I mean, the idea of people stuck in their roles and being in their roles is entertaining for the rest of the spectators. But if we want to have sane, real people involved in the world, then we have to let people be people themselves as well, or else there we've just got these lost souls looking through the, you know, the mirror into the mirror into the mirror of themselves, and they're useless people they have running the world and interpreting things for us and being our artists and everything. So we actually need to protect the personhood of our public characters just like we do with everybody else, or it's a mad world and we don't want to live in it, I think.
Maybe that's a good place to end.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you both for a fascinating conversation. It's been fantastic. Do please enjoy the exhibition and engage in conversation amongst yourselves. But thank you all for coming.